loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. European elections have been upended once again. Yesterday's Italian elections are set to produce a deadlocked parliament as the populist Five Stars movement and the far-right Northern League surge, leaving the center-left bloc of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in an embarrassing third place. What's next in Italian politics? And then, the Trump administration and Congress have been working to dismantle, to sabotage, the Affordable Care Act, despite their failure to outright repeal the law. While some states have embraced this effort, others are pushing back.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the leaders of West Virginia teachers' unions say that they will remain out on strike after the state Senate voted to cut the 5% pay increase they negotiated with the governor. Meanwhile, teachers in Oklahoma are discussing a strike inspired by West Virginia. Is this the beginning of a wave of teacher activism? Next, today is the last day of the NAFTA talks between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. After intense anti-NAFTA rhetoric on the campaign trail, President Trump has now taken the position that if what he calls a new and fair NAFTA agreement can be agreed upon, then he'll exempt our two neighboring countries from the steel and aluminum tariffs. Then the Israeli extreme right has a high profile at the ongoing annual conference of AIPAC, the largest pro-Israel lobby in the country, with the seminar being held today headlining some of the biggest names in the pro-settler movement. This comes hours before Netanyahu and Trump are scheduled to meet here in Washington, with confrontation with Iran high on the agenda. And then, in the first visit of high-ranking South Korean officials to North Korea since Kim Jong-un took office in 2011, South Korea's National Security Office Director and its intelligence agency head led a 10-person delegation to North Korea to discuss a potential historic meeting of the leaders of both Koreas. And finally, Venezuela's presidential election, which had been scheduled for late April, has been postponed until May 20th, as a faction of the opposition breaks ranks and decides to participate. Will the country's Bolivarian revolution continue? In other headlines, special counsel Robert Mueller has sent a subpoena to former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg requiring all communication and documents from November 1, 2015 onward related to Trump and a list of nine close associates. Nunberg says that he will tear up the subpoena live on Bloomberg television, and he's daring Mueller to have him arrested. A speeding off-duty police officer crashed into a woman's car in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, killing the one-year-old baby of Brittany Stevens. Outrageously, it was Stevens who was charged with failing to properly secure her child. Meanwhile, a leak of internal New York Police Department documents revealed 300 cases of misconduct by NYPD employees. ManorCare, a leading healthcare company that worked in nursing, assisted living, and long-term care, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy after revenues did not cover rent since 2012. The equity group that owns ManorCare, the Carlyle Group, will sell the company to the landlord Quality Care. In the deal, ManorCare's former executive, who retired in September, will receive $100 million. The Social Democratic Party of Germany voted to join a coalition government with Angela Merkel's conservatives over the weekend. Despite notable internal dissent, the members of the Social Democrats voted by a wide margin in favor of the coalition deal. Under the arrangement, Merkel's Christian Democrats will lose control of the finance ministry to the Social Democrats. Those are today's headlines. Next up is an interview on the elections in Italy, where the right wing is ascending. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the elections in Italy. Yesterday's Italian elections are set to produce a deadlocked parliament as the populist Five Stars movement and the far-right National League surge, leaving the center-left bloc of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in an embarrassing third place. We are joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for the Green Left Weekly. And in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Dick Nichols and Walter, welcome.
Glad to be here.
First of all, Dick Nichols, one, were you surprised by what happened in Italy? And two, big picture, how important is this?
I didn't find it surprising at all, Brian. I think what all the indications were that a lot of people is in the south and the north were going to desert their traditional parties, both to the right and to the centre-right and to the centre-left. And in the end, that's exactly what happened. If you compare the actual final result to what the average of the polls was, the Lega Nord got more, 2%, roughly 2% more, and the Five Star Movement got 2.5-3% more. And that was basically, you know, a lot of people just giving these parties a chance because they're fed up with traditional politics. A lot of it is, there's a lot of talk about there being a racist component to this, which of course is true, a very racist, strong racist component. But in the case of the Five Star Movement, it's important to understand that they had some pretty progressive, or have some promised some pretty progressive economic policies against poverty, guaranteed minimum income, etc. And that was probably a more important determinant in the South. How important is this being? I think this is incredibly important because it makes the whole of European politics much more fragile. There's going to be an enormous tussle in Italy by the establishment to try and either prevent a five-star government coming, this five-star being the centre of a government because they can't govern by themselves, or to actually form a sort of anti-five-star holy coalition. So I think we can expect a very tense struggle in Italian politics, even more tense than is usually the case after these hung elections, which are the usual thing you have in Italy.
Dick, Matteo Salvini, one of the right-wing party leaders in Italy, says that he has a gentleman's agreement with Silvio Berlusconi, whereby whichever party has the most votes at the end, that party leader will be prime minister. Berlusconi says that no such agreement has taken place. Are we going to see a fight there between those two politicians, those two parties? And if so, do you think that it could actually prevent the right from establishing a coalition government?
Well, the right's going to have a problem establishing a coalition government, even if they manage to agree amongst themselves. And this is a sort of standard fights inside the right in Italy, and especially with Berlusconi, who is used to being, the big leader. This will be, if they go by general arrangements, which doesn't require this particular agreement that Salvini says he has, Salvini would be their candidate for prime minister. But that's not that doesn't solve the problem because they've only got 36, 37, 38% of the seats. So they have to find a way of getting more support. And probably the only way they could get support, and I don't think this is even feasible, but, you know, let's just put it out there. The only way they can get support is for Salvini not to be their candidate because on his positions they're so racist. They're so racist towards the south of Italy because don't forget that Lega Nord started as a movement for this fictitious place called Padania, and has now just turned itself into a kind of national front operation for the whole of Italy. But they are still very, very, very disliked in the south because of their anti-south racism. So if they were going to attract forces, say the right wing of the centre-left, which would be the only way they could get into government, then Salvini is probably not going to be their parliamentary candidate. So what you've got is an extremely blocked situation. And I've just been following the Italian coverage today, and what everybody is saying that they don't see a solution, an immediate solution to this, and that a likely arrangement will be that there'll be a technical government. They can't agree amongst themselves without losing support from their own base because they all said before the election campaign, where they all denied they were going to have coalition agreements for government with each other. Anybody, the first person who changes that position is the one that's likely to lose support from their own voting base. So that opens up the possibility that you have what's been, quite common in Italian politics, which is a sort of president's government, a technical government, like the Mario Monti government, And that would obviously be what would be most welcome to the European Commission. So what you would have is we put all this on hold, we have a technical government, and then if necessary we go to new elections. If necessary, we even have a new electoral law to make sure we get a result from them.
I'm looking at a map of Italy here, Walter, and it's colored, and it shows which party won in which area, and it's down to the precinct, so it's quite a map. The center right is blue, Five Star is yellow, the center left is red, and Free and Equal is gray. Almost this entire map is blue and yellow. Certainly the entire half, northern half of Italy is center right. And almost the entire southern half is Five Star, which leaves not much territory for the center left. Are we seeing the end of progressivism in Italy? You know, the right has been, it seems like it's been building and building over the years. Now they're focused on things like immigration, for example, and expelling all immigrants. Is this going to continue as a trend, or is there some way that the left can come back in Italy?
Yeah, the decline of the left in Italy has been a long and painful process that's been going on for a couple decades. So from the period between the end of World War II until, you know, throughout most of the 1980s, the two main parties in Italian politics were the Christian Democrats on the center right and the Communist Party. That was the other major party, which received, you know, somewhere between 25 and 35% of the votes in most elections. The Democratic Party, which is the party of now outgoing Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, they actually traced their roots back to the Communist Party. They went through many iterations. First, I think they were called Democratic Left, and then they merged with certain other forces, and they've reached this sort of big tent center-left party that's no longer ideologically communist, but can trace its organizational roots back to that. Free and Equal is sort of the faction of the left that didn't want to go along and join the Democratic Party, but were also themselves, you know, sort of shedding their previous communist political orientation. And then there are a couple other smaller organizations, including Power to the People and the newly formed party, Communist Party, which got a much, much smaller level of the vote. And so I think that, their move towards the center, the political center, which includes the imposition of austerity measures. Italy is a heavily indebted economy. They have, you know, I think 130 or 140% of their debt, or their debt is 130 or 140% of GDP. They've been implementing budget cuts, labor law, quote unquote, reforms, diminishing the rights of workers. And so I think that the traditional voting base of the left has gone either to the Five Star movement, which is, as you pointed out, popular in the less economically developed South, or in the North. You know, the reporting, the electoral reporting shows that, they just report like the center right bloc won in the North. But really, the composition of the center right bloc has changed so much so as that now the far right Northern League led by Matteo Salvini, Salvini's party is now the dominant, quote unquote, center right party, even though it is very, very far to the right. And that's what a lot of those northern voters, that's who a lot of those northern voters went for.
And in fact, people are complaining. I'm looking at an Italian politics chat room right now, and people are complaining quite strenuously that calling Berlusconi, for example, center right is irresponsible. That the center has moved so far to the right that what we're calling the center is nowhere near the center. Of course, we're seeing that in other countries too. We see that in Israel. We've spoken about it on this show a couple of times. But it seems like the left, and even not that far left, not talking about the Italian Communist Party, but just talking about liberals, have been pushed almost out of the political process. The only place where they've exhibited any strength is around Florence, around Bologna, and then in the far north along the border with Switzerland. Other than that, they didn't get votes anywhere.
It's a bit, we've got to be a bit careful here. A lot of the reason why the traditional left, and that's it, all left, you know, including the Democratic Party, which is, you know, almost was a Blairite party when it was in government, and certainly under Renzi was a ferociously Blairite, Macronite party. I mean, what Renzi was after was getting on the Macron bandwagon and that vision of where Europe should be going. That that left discredited itself so many times, you know, beginning with centre-left governments going right back to the 90s without going into all the history, that traditional left voters just abandoned it. And the problem was that there was no left to the left of the traditional Social Democratic Party, which had actually come out of the Communist Party, had been the right wing of the old Communist Party. But there was never a sort of enough strength to the left of that in the Party of Rifondazione Comunista, Party of Communist Refoundation, to actually draw people, hold that electorate. And so that electorate fragmented and atomized, became demoralized, didn't participate. And that's the preconditions, the social preconditions for the five-star movement emerging. Now, the five-star movement emerges with a blah-blah rhetoric about we are neither left nor right, we try and solve people's problems, which is less than accurate. And what happened is that the five-star movement starts as something that appeals to all people, on the basis of not being ideological. But its actual concrete policies are a set of contradictions. So if Five Star ever got into government, it would be under enormous pressure. This is already visible where it is in government at municipal level, for example, in Rome. These teams, five-star teams, sort of pull themselves apart. The whole thing was held together by Beppe Grillo as the kind of Bonapartist person who just said, you're fired, you're not fired, you're good people, you're bad people, on an almost daily basis. Now, that might be able to operate at the level of municipal government or even regional government, but at national government, that can't work. All I'm trying to say, really, through all of that, is that a lot of the progressive poor and working class, rural working class, social base has gone, especially in the South, and overwhelmingly in the South, has gone to Five Star. Five Star's promised these policies, which are basically left policies. Their economic policy is like taken from Joseph Stiglitz and Piketty, guaranteed minimum income. Well, guaranteeing minimum income so that against poverty is absolute anathema to the European Commission and neoliberals in general. So I just say, while the traditional left has disintegrated and discredited itself over the years, as Walter pointed out, that left sentiment is still there. Look, and always is trying to find a way to express itself politically, and is expressing itself in a distorted way, yes, inside Five Star.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, the five-star movement emerged at a time in European politics where the traditional institutions of the European Union were really fraying at the edges, you know, not quite at the beginning of the financial crisis, but after, austerity was imposed on, you know, many countries, including the so-called peripheral countries of the European Union, sometimes called the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, and Ireland. And so I think that, you know, that type of, disillusionment led a significant section of the Italian population, especially youth who are sort of, you know, permanently unemployed or permanently underemployed, to look for some kind of political alternative. There are definitely progressive sentiments, I think, that predominated at that time. And that was certainly present in the formation, for sure, of the five-star movement.
Let's go back to trace the left here in Italy, because we have the five-star movement, which is eclectic. It's not hard right, although there may be hard right elements attracted to it. There's the Northern Alliance, which is a hard right and xenophobic and in many ways racist movement. Now, the left, Dick, the Communist Party, which formed, say, an electoral front, I think it was called the Popular Front in 1948, 70 years ago this year. At that time, that was right after World War II, where the Italian left, and particularly the Italian Communist Party, led the armed resistance against Mussolini and against the Nazi occupiers in the northern half of Italy. They had a vote of about 30%, one out of every three in 1948. That made the U.S. go crazy. The United States went nuts. the Cold War was in large measure not only about what happened to Eastern Europe, but what was going to happen in terms of the participation of the Communist Party either in France or in Italy. So we had this very strong tradition of leftism because the leftists led the armed struggle against fascism. Then during and they were also allies of the Soviet Union. Now during the 1960s, and then in an even more pronounced way, the Italian Communist Party developed its own route. It was what, in many ways, the leadership along with the French and the Spanish Communist Party of what was called Eurocommunism, meaning a communism that would be, in popular vernacular, adjustable to the realities of popular representative democracy in Western Europe, as opposed to being a prototype of or a puppet of the Soviet Union, as they would have said it. Still, they were very, very large as they became more and more politically moderate, moving more to the center, moving really in the direction of social democracy. And now here we are a couple decades later, and that party has completely dissipated. I mean, really, it has dissipated. It's gone. It's now has another organizational iterations, other programs, but it doesn't have a coherency that the Communist Party once had, to be a challenge both to the center elites and to the ultra-right fascist sectors of Italian politics. This is a very demoralizing thing, not certainly for Italian leftists, but under the current circumstances, will organizations like Five Star become the new vessel for an attempt to reorganize the left, or will this come somewhere else?
There's no way, I don't think, you know, how politics works. Even though that you've got a lot of progressive sentiment and people voting for Five Star on the basis of progressive sentiment and for their progressive policies, there's no way Five Star by itself, as it is now, is going to evolve into anything like the old Communist Party, because they deliberately say end of ideology. That is to say, no, there's no such thing as classes. It's just Italian people trying to find their best, you know, serve politics that serves the best interests of the Italian people. So that's not going to happen. So the problem then becomes, as always, one of where does sufficiently in socially rooted but clearly socialist politics express itself. Now, Power to the People, which is this new social movement from below ticket that stood in this election, I still think, a very promising thing. I don't think it was realistic to expect that they would get more than they got, which was just over 1%. But this is an expression in Italian politics of social resistance. And you have the whole history of in Italian politics of social resistance, the social centres, all the movements that go on in spite of or against mainstream institutional politics, even and including left politics or left electoralist politics. And the expression on Power to the People as an expression of that is I think, an encouraging sign. It's a bit, to compare very different things, it's a bit like the People's Unity lists here in Catalonia. It starts off as a political movement to represent at the level of institutional politics, struggle, social struggle, and has a left dynamic because of that, and attracts the young people. This is the key social fact about it. You know, it attracts the young people. So all the elements are there for there to be a big there will be continuing conflict in Italy at all levels, the institutional level. We'll see now, you know, the games around the results of this election, plus at the social level. How will all this play out? I think it'd be very brave to make predictions about it. But, you know, some of the elements that could lead to a regeneration of the left are starting to come into place. What you've had really is had a whole two generations of working people who've just had a bad experience of people who call themselves left. And this goes back to, I think, one of the worst things that happened, and I won't go on for too long about this, but one of the worst things that happens was that when you had, quote, the end of communism and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the majority of people in the Communist Party said, oh, well, that's it, it's all finished. Whereas at least the French Communist Party, and there's all sorts of criticisms you might want to make about the French Communist Party, but at least they kept going, and at least they provide a sort of, you know, a left pole. You can, as I say, you can make all sorts of criticisms in, and a pole of reference for a point of reference for left politics in France, which is makes a big difference when you compare that to the situation in Italy.
Thank you for that, and Walter, we have just about 3 minutes left. Again, the point that Dick is making, and the point I was also trying to get at, is that if the right has a centralism, if it has determination, if it's anchored in that kind of organization that has a vision, even a right-wing, far-right, or even fascistic vision, it stands for something people know, and that under conditions of duress or conditions of crisis becomes a magnet, because an extreme and organized party seems resolute and able to solve society's crisis. If the left has this sort of eclectic, semi-anarchistic, no leaders, no ideology, how does it weather the storm? How does it become a magnet? Yes, for a moment in an electoral situation, it becomes an alternative to the right. But, you know, bottom line is electoral politics don't settle society's crisis. I mean, it seems to me that's the task. Otherwise, the far right will continue to gain steam in Italy and elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree. And in any society where there's a profound crisis, you know, an economic crisis, a social crisis, a crisis of political legitimacy of the ruling system, you know, people want radical solutions. And if, you know, the left, which has traditionally been the dominant section of Italian politics, at least, you know, in the post-war period, if they're unable to put forward this, you know, such a program, then that leaves a tremendous amount of space open. It leaves a vacuum open for the far right. And, you know, they do have some of these extremely centralized organizations. The most unambiguously fascist force in Italian politics is called Casa Pound. They got about 1% of the vote in the last election. But they're, you know, this, you know, fascist party of a traditional type. And so, you know, even though like Matteo Salvini and the other far right parties might be or not be organized along similar lines, I think in terms of the battle of ideas, that's definitely a correct point that you're raising.
Dick Nichols, 45 seconds left, so you get the final word. Go ahead.
The big problem is what is in people's heads. And if you've got millions and millions of working class and poor people who think the problem is migrants, immigrants, and if we got rid of the immigrants, and you know, Berlusconi, in his desperate fight to stay ahead of Salvini, said, "I'll get rid of 600,000." If that becomes a sort of received wisdom, then we've got a huge problem, and that's the battle. I mean, the fundamental battle is to get the message through that the enemy is not some poor African migrants or people from Syria. The enemy is your nationalists at home. And that, you know, that's the struggle in the whole of Europe. That's not going to be easy in Italy, because Italy has been left just to bear the brunt of all immigration and refugees coming across the Mediterranean. And the vote for the Northern League has jumped on the basis of that scapegoating. That's the core problem.
Thank you. We've been joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He's the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly, and in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The Trump administration and Congress have been working to dismantle the Affordable Care Act despite their failure to outright repeal the law. While some states have embraced this other effort, others are pushing back. We are joined in studio by Leo Cuello. He is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. And from Bennington, Vermont, by Mary Garish, an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. Welcome back, Leo, and welcome back, Mary.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Leo, let's talk about this. We have a little bit of time. We're going to take the next 28 minutes to try to help the audience understand what efforts are underway and what the methods are of these efforts to do something that the Republicans were unable to do, which was to repeal the Affordable Care Act. What's going on? What are the methods being used? And then we want to talk about the pushback also from different communities in different states. Let's start with you and then take it to Mary.
Sure. So it has been a steady drumbeat of an effort to sabotage the Affordable Care Act from day one of the Trump administration. And in thinking about it, we sort of categorize it into sort of four buckets of activities. You have the attempts to take out major structural pieces of the law. We can talk about those, the individual mandate, cost sharing reductions. Second, you have an attempt to attack the enrollment process, the things that actually make it so that people enroll in coverage. Third, you have the attempt to take out all of the standards that the Affordable Care Act created to make sure that we have coverage available to people with pre-existing conditions, to make sure it's affordable, to make sure that the health insurance actually covers what you need. And then last, as fourth, as we've talked about on this show before, the attempts to attack the Medicaid side of the ledger, particularly the Medicaid expansion, through misuse of waiver authority in Medicaid. And that combination of things has just been a very clear and systematic approach to trying to make the Affordable Care Act crash and burn.
It seems to me that the Republicans, as you note, are trying to accomplish through 1,000 cuts what they couldn't establish legislatively. And the people who are going to suffer at the end of the day are people like you and me, or even worse, people who otherwise can't afford coverage. Mary, tell us about these Republican attempts, state by state, to allow the formation or the creation of insurance policies that really don't cover much because they're so inexpensive.
Right. And the problem is, when they allow you to pay these policies, you're paying for nothing, really, because the policy not only doesn't cover the things that it should cover, like pre-existing conditions or like children that are in college, under the age of 26, all of that stuff. So they're taking your money. It's a really good scam. I mean, I'll say that for it, because they're taking your money and they're doing nothing in return, because you probably can't afford the copays. Even if you can afford the copays, you're probably not covered because of the limitations of the policy. And your deductible is probably so high that you could just about pay your whole bill with the deductible anyway, which of course you can't afford to pay, because that's the whole reason you buy insurance, is that you can't afford to go bankrupt over your health insurance bills. Of course, in this country, we all know that's one of the largest causes of bankruptcy. And what's worse is that there are people who don't even have the assets to go bankrupt, and they just die from not getting health care. I think that all of these methods that were just mentioned to try and cut away at the minimal protections, and when I say that, in Obamacare or the ACA, yes, the ACA is a great thing because so many people benefited by it for so many reasons, like pre-existing coverages and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, it does not get the insurance companies out of the mix, but it did regulate them somewhat, so that at least they weren't allowed to run roughshod over people's right to health care and profit by it. None of these things are going to allow that. And I know that some states have considered, or I think in a couple of instances have actually instituted back an individual mandate where people have to buy insurance. And I think what they've done is they've said that the penalties that would be incurred if you don't buy insurance can instead be applied towards a down payment on an insurance policy. That's all well and good, but, I'm a grassroots organizer. So most of the folks that I run into, they're not buying insurance because they can't afford it. And no, they can't afford the penalty either, but it's a choice between two evils. So they don't buy the insurance because if they do, they probably can't pay their rent or buy food for their kids, right? And so by saying, well, you can use it for a down payment on an insurance policy, they still can't pay the insurance premiums, deductibles, and co-pays. For some people, it's a very hollow gesture. It's definitely an advancement for those folks who are able to afford the premiums. But as you may recall, and as other people know who know me, anything that still has insurance companies in the mix isn't giving us our right to health care. We need a Medicare for All universal single-payer system.
That's Mary Guerra. She's an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. We're talking to her from Bennington, Vermont. We're in studio with Leonardo Cuello. He's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. I'm just guessing, Leo, that we all agree that there should be improved Medicare for all people, that it's a better system, that healthcare shouldn't be doled out as a commodity, that we shouldn't be necessarily dependent on private health insurance companies to access it. But that said, we're still working within this existing framework where the Affordable Care Act changed the way in which the insurance companies and thus healthcare services were made accessible for the population. And for parts of the population, people were able to access healthcare, people who had never been receiving any healthcare. And that's because of expanded Medicaid, for instance. Let's talk, because that's one of the four buckets that you talked about in terms of the slash and burn sabotage that the Republicans and Trump are carrying out. Let's talk about the Medicaid. What's going on in that front?
So, right, one of the critical elements of the Affordable Care Act is the Medicaid expansion, which is basically the vehicle which covers half of the people who get coverage under the Affordable Care Act. So this is a significant vehicle to coverage, and the efforts to undermine the Medicaid expansion are picking up. We have, you know, the head of CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and on the Medicaid side, you know, that person basically came out and said Medicaid should only be for these types of people and came out against the Medicaid expansion. And so, as you know, that approach has led to them issuing exceptions to Medicaid requirements now in three states, Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas, allowing them to do provisions that actually result in people losing coverage, losing access to services. So they are worsening the healthcare programs to the tune of, in Kentucky, 100,000 people will lose their coverage.
And why do they lose it? What are the main reasons?
So they lose their coverage because they approved eight different waivers in Kentucky. Some of those waivers include things like a work requirement, so that if you can't actually prove that you're working or prove you're a student or prove you have a good reason not to be, you will get terminated. There is a premium. If you fail to pay the premium, you're not only terminated, but you're locked out of coverage. If you fail to submit redetermination forms, fail to notify them when you have a change in circumstance, you also not only get terminated, but locked out of the program. So you take the effect of all of these things, you put them together, that's 100,000 people who lose coverage. So they were unable to legislatively repeal the Medicaid expansion. And so what they are doing is going in, you know, I always say they couldn't close the restaurant, so they're going in the kitchen and ruining the food, right? And that's what they're trying to make this coverage no longer work for the people who depend on the coverage. And it is going to result in hundreds of thousands of people, eventually millions, losing coverage.
And who grants these states, mostly led by Republican legislatures or Republican governors, who grants them the waiver? How does it work?
So it's the Trump administration that will ultimately approve it. It's the HHS secretary who has the ultimate authority as to whether to approve the waiver requested by the state. But HHS themselves actually submitted or issued guidance encouraging states to do applications like work requirements. So this was this is something that states are doing also at the kind of beckon of HHS. Health and Human Services.
Mary, as you mentioned, you're a grassroots organizer and advocate in the state of Vermont. Bernie Sanders is a senator from the state of Vermont. Bernie Sanders advocates for and has introduced legislation for a single-payer Medicare. I don't remember the name of the bill, but it's got quite a number of signers. let's just talk about the people you're in contact with. Who's on the ground in Vermont? Are people able to, and are people accessing the Affordable Care Act? What's the main benefit that you're seeing? And then what are the main problems that people have with the system?
Okay, and I'm going to actually include New Hampshire as well, because we also do a lot of work there. And New Hampshire actually did vote on a work requirement for Medicaid, and which I don't think has gone into effect yet, but it's a very scary prospect. Vermont was considering it. It's interesting because very many of the people that are, and I'm not really sure how you define anymore these days, middle class. So I'm going to say people like that are young professionals maybe or whatever, who couldn't afford at all to buy insurance, are now able to get insurance. And that's a really good thing. So there are, and I hate to quote a figure because my memory isn't good on figures, but there are many thousands of people in Vermont who, because of the Affordable Care Act, actually can access insurance now. And these are the folks who are young and raising families and that sort of thing. Then there's a whole other group of folks who receive Medicaid, and it's really the only way they have to provide medical care for themselves and their families. Yes, we have a few free clinics, that sort of thing. But what we see is people who are just really struggling. And, you know, what really, of course, for me as a grassroots organizer, the real point is that the human suffering is incredibly wrong. But if we just look at even the fiscal aspect of it, which a lot of the Republicans want to look at, I really don't get it, because unless they cut out Medicaid completely, which I know is their goal. I mean, we've been down in D.C. protesting a lot and talking to people, and they're really trying to cut out Medicaid completely. They're trying to form other programs that they say are going to be much better that, in fact, are not, as Leo was just saying. And so people are really confused. They're really suffering. And they're scared. I mean, they're scared that their Medicaid, I can't tell you, people walk into the offices of like the Center for Independent Living here in Vermont, which helps serve people who are differently abled. And they'll call there several times a week because they're in a panic that their Medicaid is going to get cut. And people are literally afraid. They don't know what to do. And they can't even afford a lot of times to pay the minimal copays that they have with Medicaid for certain medications. So they really are being driven down and down. And unfortunately, we have an enormous opioid epidemic here in Vermont, and well, across the country, but in Vermont as well. And that is growing constantly. And I think it's because a lot of people are self-medicating. People don't know what to do. All of these cuts seem minor to a legislator who makes, I don't know, between 60 and who knows how much a year. $60,000, I think, would probably be a moderate figure for a legislator to make per year. And so for them, the idea that there's a little bit of a copay for Medicaid now is not a big deal, because A, well, they don't even have to worry about it because they get theirs paid through the government. But B, it's like nothing. Like, they might spend that on going to a movie twice a week.
That's the voice of Mary Guerra. She's an organizer, a grassroots advocate with the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team in Vermont. We're also joined in studio by Leonardo Cuello, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leonardo, let's turn back to you. You identified in the beginning that the sabotage against the Affordable Care Act could be broken down into four buckets, sort of just ways, categories that are of things that are under attack. And we talked about Medicaid and the attempt to drive people off of Medicaid. You mentioned maybe 100,000 people might lose Medicaid in Kentucky. Let's talk about the one of the other buckets, the attack on enrollment, because part of the Affordable Care Act's premise is that enough healthy people will be in the insurance pool that it will help mediate costs. Talk about how the enrollment is being attacked.
Right. So the enrollment, we got a clear signal in the first week of the Trump administration. The enrollment window to pick your ACA plan in 2017 ran until January 31st. Trump comes in, right, 10 days from the end of that enrollment period. By mid-January, that enrollment period was at a record-setting pace. And what do they do? I believe it was 4 days in, they decide, we're going to cancel advertising for the last week of open enrollment, right? The last week, of course, being the most critical week where all of these people who were kind of waiting to put their paperwork together submit in the last week. And so they canceled all the advertising for that last week of open enrollment. And sure enough, what was enrollment to come out ahead of pace came out behind pace. Now, that's what they did with 10 days to work with. For the open enrollment period for 2018, they had a full year. And so they just came up with this incredible strategy of all of these different things to reduce the amount of people getting enrolled. So what did they do? That open enrollment period, which was 90 days, they cut it to 45 days. So now instead of going through January 31st, it ends on December 15th. There are assisters, people who are funded to help you pick a plan and figure out what the plan will cover and does it cover your doctor and help you actually get the right plan. They cut the funding for those assisters by 40%. They then cut the funding for outreach by 90%, whereas they used to, for example, email everybody who they had a record for. Now they started only emailing people who had current enrollment status, right? So they basically reduced the outreach. They stopped partnerships with a lot of influential groups. That was something that helped drive enrollment. And they even told regional Health and Human Services staff that they should stop attending local community enrollment events, which were done to try and increase enrollment. So it was this just huge effort to suppress enrollment in Affordable Care Act plans. Imagine the deadline for enrollment was 45 days earlier than it was the year before, right? So that caught a lot of people off guard. And I think there are two stories here, right? One story is the ultimate enrollment result did decrease from 9.2 million to 8.8 million. However, I think a piece of the story is they tried so hard to, right, destroy that figure. And they only actually got it to drop a little bit. And so I think the story here is they came up with every idea they could to sabotage the enrollment period, and basically almost the same number of people still enrolled. And I think that that has really subverted their effort to say, hey, this program is, nobody likes Obamacare. That talking point is really hard to defend when you trashed the enrollment process and tried to prevent everybody from enrolling, and 8.8 million people still got to the finish line.
So then let me ask a question. Let's say the Democrats do well in this midterm election. They win back the House of Representatives, at least. Will anything change, or has so much damage been done to Obamacare that it's just going to start withering on the vine now?
Oh, no. I definitely think that this is, the criticisms of Obamacare are dramatically exaggerated, first of all. So the program is working. More importantly, with proper implementation, the Trump administration, nobody was asking them to come and be the biggest allies to Obamacare ever. We were just saying, do your job. You're the executive branch. Your job is to execute the laws of the land, right? If you disagree with the tax law, if you disagree with immigration law, if you disagree with healthcare law, you can be a part of the legislative process to change the law, but you can't undermine the law through your executive action. That's, in fact, one of the bases for our lawsuit against the Trump administration for what they did in Kentucky, because what they are doing is not implementing the law, which the Constitution requires them to do. And even half-competent administration that was trying to just do its job would be getting this right, especially when you talk about the fact that there are all these states out there that are really trying to partner with the government to improve this system.
Leonardo, before we go back to Mary, I want to ask you a quick follow-up question on that. One, the status of your lawsuit, and also does legal action have to take every piece of this piece by piece? Does it have to all be within the different buckets, or can there be like an omnibus legal action that deals with the multitude and ways in which there's efforts underway by the Trump administration to break the law? In other words, to violate the law or to undermine the law?
Well, so to answer the second question first, sadly, you know, these are kind of piecemeal pieces of litigation. You know, I will say the one silver lining to that fact that you have to kind of litigate these out one by one is exactly one of the things that they did to the Obama administration, right, was they came up with every ridiculous theory that they could for litigation and then just had somebody go to court and file it. And so the Obama administration spent its time defending itself from, you know, umpteen different lawsuits. And so this is an area where it does actually take them time to respond to all of the lawsuits being filed, you know, in all of the different areas. So at least one of the good things is that all the time that they spend defending themselves on one of those these lawsuits is time that they don't spend thinking about some other terrible thing to do.
Let's go back to Mary again. Let's get a sense of how this is playing out in Vermont. So Leo made the point that 9.2 million people had enrolled in the Affordable Care Act the year before. And this year, after all of these efforts to downplay advertising, to cut staff, to cut all the ways that the normal ways in which people would be recruited into the program, in spite of that, the number went from 9.2 million to 8.8 million, a drop of 400,000 people. That's a lot of people. But from a statistical point of view, it didn't really torpedo the entire program. What about what you're seeing in Vermont? Are you seeing the failures or the deliberate efforts to wreck advertising or to wreck enrollment impacting on people's decisions about enrollment?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a really good point that Leo made. And in fact, as an organizer, a community organizer, it gives me great hope because what we saw here was that a lot of the advisor people that Leo was just talking about, even though their funding was cut, we're still working at outreach centers, food banks, free clinics, and volunteering their time to help people sign up in time. And they did everything possible to let people know about the cutback on the enrollment dates. And what it really spoke to was the will of the people, at least in the Northeast, to make sure that folks were cared for and not to fall prey to the subversion of our democracy as planned by the Republicans and not to buy into this stuff. And that's hopeful for me because I think that gives us the hope that in the future we can have an even better system. And as you pointed out, being from Bernie's state, my version of a better system would definitely be national single-payer health care. But the point is that people are getting involved because even people who were in the business of trying to help folks get insurance and were originally getting paid for it were so outraged by these tactics that they said, wait, we have to get together and do something here. And that could ultimately, and I think will ultimately be a force to be reckoned with.
Very interesting. It's this classic situation where you have grassroots activism, an unmet need, a dire need. And, you know, this is not an ideological issue. People.
Yeah, everybody needs health care.
We're humans and we get sick and our kids get sick. So there's kind of a universality to the issue. So there's grassroots activism. There's outrage because people recognize that this is sabotage, that this is the executive branch of the government trying to destroy people's lives, actually, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about human beings' lives. And at the same time, we have Leonardo Cuello here who's filing litigation. I mean, we have a situation where in spite of and maybe because of the attacks on healthcare, there can be a resistance. Resistance is an overused word. So let's strike that from the record for the moment. There can be a movement that fights back and fights back with efficacy. Go ahead, Leo.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, when you go back to the topic that we started talking about, which was sort of these junk insurance topics, what that topic is really about is about minimum federal standards, about saying in this insurance market that's out there, it's not going to be just the law of the jungle. We are going to say that as a country, there are certain standards that we expect to be in place in every state, right? And we do that for education, and we do that for highway safety, and we do that for food control, right? And all the ACA did was say, we expect that same thing in healthcare. And so what we really need is this sort of recognition that there should be some flexibility at the state level. You have a state like Vermont, which is always ahead of the curve. And if Vermont wants to take the national standards and improve them, great. But if Mississippi doesn't want to improve the national standards, okay, that's their choice, but those national standards should be there. And so a junk insurance that is either providing a deductible that's so high that the person will never actually be able to use the coverage, or not covering maternity benefits, which is what this individual market was doing before, right? We can't have a health insurance market that does that. And so all we really need is some consensus about the fact that there should be some minimums about what we expect people to get regarding healthcare. And that's really all we're saying. And I think that a movement around that is already there.
And I believe a movement even around the minimums, and this is the way things happen in history, because what we really deserve is to have healthcare as a right.
Every American.
And not, it shouldn't be a commodity. It should be, you know, we all need it. It shouldn't be a thing of profit. But as we fight for these minimum standards, as Leo was saying, as we attempt to make healthcare at least at the same level as our use of cars or other things that we all know are regulated, even as we do that, if a movement grows, even if it's a defensive movement at first against, say, the Trump attacks, I think it will grow into a bigger discussion and a bigger demand about healthcare, because I actually think it's the time has come. Nowhere else in the advanced industrial world is this a right-left issue, in fact. This is just a fundamental understanding of people's basic rights.
Yeah, I know. The point is, cancer doesn't discriminate. The cancer doesn't ask, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican, right? And there's very few people in this country who haven't had, you know, cancer impact their family somehow. And so this is a common experience we all have, and we need to speak to the facts around it and not let the other side speak to the fear.
That's all the time we have. We've been joined in studio by Leonardo Cuello, an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program, and from Bennington, Vermont, by Mary Gerrish, an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.